No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the conversation by calling in at 888-628-6008, or you can Skype your questions to BBSRADIO and the number 1. Maria, how are you?
Hey, favorite day of the year.
Yeah.
Pacific Daylight Time, Eastern Daylight Time. I love, love, love this. And we didn't even mention it last week when we signed off that
now, this is going to be the day. Is it different in California? No, it's an hour, right?
It's an hour, but we have more sunshine.
Yeah, because I know, because Arizona is strange, right? They're the one place that's not on it.
Arizona, there's Hawaii, and there's a little Hawaii section in the Midwest, like a Illinois-ish section that does it. But yes, we do honor it, and I wish we just did it all year long, and I love it that it's more, not less, and et cetera. And Michael, can we talk about the fact that I'm coming to D.C. and we're going to broadcast from somewhere, and we want our listeners to come? And
we're looking for a place now to do it, you know, but yes, Maria's coming to D.C. and I'm so excited because Maria and I have been on the air together for a very long time now, and we've never met.
Yes, in person. So, indeed. Yeah. And Mrs. Brown, too.
And Mrs. Brown, yes.
Yeah, I'm so excited. So I have to be there for a conference, and it also is a university thing. And so that is the, quote, excuse that I get to come and fly out east, and I get to meet you in person and see your – I haven't been to D.C. I was there with the American Red Cross in, like, 2010. So it's been a long time.
Well, and then all we have to do is think of an excuse for me to come to Los Angeles, because the last time I was in that area, California, last time I was in Los Angeles, for example, was for the convention in 2000. So it's been an even longer time.
Oh, wow.
You know, yeah. And if you don't count the fact that we stopped at the Los Angeles airport on our way to Hawaii with the kids.
Oh, right. That's right. You did that recently.
Well, no, that was even 10 years ago.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, it was a little, you know, I think I've known you longer than I think I do. Yeah, absolutely.
So do you mind giving us a little bit, before we bring on our so interesting guests, about what's going on with your campaign and your
reaction? Well, interestingly, in my campaign, I now have a challenger. So,
you're kidding.
No, so we'll see in the Democratic primary. But you know, the campaign really starts when you get this signature thing done. So I'm working on my signatures. They are due next Wednesday, a week from Wednesday. And then the campaign really starts in earnest. So
how many signatures?
We shoot to get 3,000 signatures. So it's because it's kind of a guessing game. The requirement is 2,000 Democrats who are properly registered at the address that they put on the petition. Mm-hmm. So, for example, you know, and this happens a lot of times when you get signatures. People will say, you know, Maria Sanchez, 123 Main Street, because that's where you live now. But when you registered to vote, you lived at 246 Jefferson Street. Mm-hmm. So that signature could be challenged. So we try to get 3,000 so that we're safe to have 2,000. And it's a great way to meet voters. I mean, it's campaigning in itself, and it's great, and I love it. The only problem is that they moved the primary up 3 months and they didn't adjust anything in the signature requirement phase.
Oh,
so
wow.
Instead of doing it in June and July, we're doing it in February and March, basically. So the weather has not, the weather actually has not been bad. But, you know, you lose you lose at least a week or so for bad weather. You know,
you haven't had the nor'easter and the cyclone and all that stuff?
The nor'easter came, and it's funny. The nor'easter came, and we didn't have the rain or the snow or any of that. But we had winds that were so bad, they knocked out power to 250,000 people. So I was out there, and, I mean, the pages were flying in my – I was flying, and all I could envision was my clipboard flying up and whacking somebody in the head, and, you know, the headline being, you know, Senator sued while out on the street, you know. So I went in that day. But yeah, we've had some bad weather, and it's been so cold sometimes in the morning. You can't do this in the middle of the day because nobody's out.
Around, really. Right.
And 65% of the people in the district in the daytime live in Maryland or Virginia. They come into the city to work. So it's really a kind of a waste of time because most of the
people
can't sign. So you got to go in the morning. You got to go in the evening to, like, metro stops where, you know, people are coming to work and coming home from work and things like that. So in the mornings, it's been so cold sometimes that we've had to call it off.
Wow. That's arduous.
But anyway, it's going along. And, you know, most of these guys, like the mayor and, you know, there are other people, they have 20, 30 people out doing it. So it's not a big deal for them. But for me, I do most of it myself. And you know, like I say, it's a great way to meet people, and you hand out literature and you talk to them. And the one thing, I have to get a hold of the sociology department as soon as this is over at the University of Maryland. They should have people out doing this the next election cycle, because it's really, really interesting, especially as the candidate. People talk to you. They tell you what's on their mind. There's also, I hate to say this, but you end up profiling people, you know, because when a metro train stops, 50 people come at you. So you know things like older people sign more than younger people, women sign more than men, you know, things like that.
That's a sociology study.
Yeah, really is.
Social science. And I'm fascinated by it because I'm studying the, you know, the behavior of humans. And that is a field that I don't think I've ever even thought about.
Well, and there's a real generational thing that young people, I think, who are more worried about the technology and identity theft and stuff like that, are really reluctant to sign. And women, young women too, you know, they've been probably told by their parents, you know, be careful what you sign. Don't, you know, I tell my kids that. So, it's easier to get older people. And also, older people understand the process, because this is the process in Washington.
Exactly.
So they've seen it. They've seen it many times. And this year they offered me an iPad, and that way you can check people as that see that they're registered. But I didn't take it because I think that would make people even more suspicious that you're doing it electronically. So I want the old paper thing. And, you know, plus which, you know, technology is not my thing. I could push the wrong button, lose everybody's signature. And that would, you know, that would be much better.
I used to say what you say, but this week I had to prepare a PowerPoint template, and somehow I did it. And I had to talk about good media versus bad media. And this old gal's learning a new trick. So,
good.
Yeah, well, it's possible, Michael.
Let's bring her. That gives me hope.
Yes.
Let's bring our guests on. We have some very interesting guests tonight.
Indeed.
They're from a group called We the People, and they're for common sense gun laws. And we have with us tonight Helen Ramsey and Lou Ann Christian. And ladies, are you with us?
Yes, we are. We're here.
Well, great.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, and thanks for listening to me and Maria prattle on about our personal things. But we have an important show tonight, because, you know, the thing that intrigued me about you ladies is that you want to reach a compromise, and I think this is so important when we're talking about gun laws, because it seems to me that we're really polarized on this issue, and we've got to do something. We can't have more incidents like Stoneman Douglas. So why don't you tell us, one of you tell us actually what your group does and what your feeling is about reaching a compromise.
And here's the other difficult question, though, is common sense isn't common.
Yeah.
So how do you define that?
Well, first of all, I'm going to start off and say that a lot of what we do sounds like what you're doing out at the subway stops. Because we're in front of the White House every Monday from 11 to 1 to try to engage the public, to try to talk to people, to try to bring more awareness to the issue of gun violence and how it is becoming a public health issue. But I'll let Helen tell you how our group got started and why we're there.
So after the shooting at Aurora in the movie theater, a couple of friends and I were so disheartened. And we said, what can we do? Let's do something. And we are children, no longer children. We are grown-ups of the 60s, but we were kids back then. And our sort of common inclination was to take to the streets, because certainly during the war in Vietnam, that was our voice. And so we thought, why don't we use that voice again? Only this time we're using our voice to engage in what we aim for, which is civil conversation, no yelling at anybody, just to see if we can find common ground. And I would say one of the most effective, we have signs, and one of the most effective signs we have is parents, lock up your guns. So this is something that even, you know, people who are hardcore say, yeah, well, that makes sense. Our kids shouldn't be able to get access to guns. So that's that's our mission, basically. And common sense, you know, we hope it's something that we can all sort of come around and coalesce on a common agreement. We don't want to see things like Parkland happen again.
Right. So the group started about 5 years ago after the Aurora shooting. I've been going for the last 4 years. I'm actually a resident of Montana, and I am here seasonally, so I'm not there at every Monday. But what we have seen over the time that we're dialoguing is that we need to try to find a way to listen to each other and a way to be able to start a dialogue into the conversation of what we can do. And that is very difficult in this polarized political climate. I think it's made it more difficult because the lobbying arm of the NRA has incited a lot of their members toward more radical opinions, and yet most of the public say they support things like background checks. So what we start to do is try to talk about those things that we can agree with. And there are many things that when you break it down and you say, look, we're not trying to take your guns away. We recognize the current interpretation of the Second Amendment. We might not agree with it, but we recognize it. And let's talk about some of those things that we can agree on, what things we can try to move forward. And I think the very first thing we have to do is recognize that there is a problem, recognize that it is a health emergency that kills 38,000 people a year now, recognize that two-thirds of those are suicide victims, and that we need to look at the problem, which has been difficult because of the lack of research that we
Lack of research. Well, and they're going to open that up, aren't they?
Yeah. Well, Maria and I had a guest on last week. I probably told you this, ladies, who is a researcher from Arizona State. She's a mathematician and a statistician. And I actually talked to her during the week, Maria. And
I was emailing with her. I think I'm going to be able to do some research with her.
Yeah, right? And they're doing, you know, and Congress has prohibited using money for gun research, which is, you know, absolutely crazy. We have to, the research doesn't hurt anybody. It doesn't hurt people who are for guns. Yes. It doesn't hurt people who are against guns. It's yeah. just getting
it's the facts.
Yeah.
And well, unfortunately, the Dickey Amendment was put forth in 1996, and that was propagated by the NRA right after research came out in 1993 that showed that you were actually more likely to be a victim of homicide or suicide in the home if you did have a gun in the home. So it's been an intentional movement to suppress research. So that's something that we definitely need to.
Which is ridiculous.
Yeah.
Because as you said, Senator, we're talking about facts. We're not talking about opinion. We're not talking about lobbying. We're not talking about agenda. We're not talking about amendments. We're talking about the facts. And we've been suppressed from finding out the facts. That's absurd.
It is absurd. And I mean, unfortunately, this political climate has made a challenge to everything that we would ordinarily say are, yes, well, that's a fact. But the news and the media have spun things in such a way that it's hard, I think, for the ordinary citizen to say, well, what is the truth? Mm-hmm. And we need to get back to a place where truth is truth and people can recognize it as such.
Well, and you know, I'm sure that you realize growing up in Montana, you probably grew up around a lot of guns. I grew up around a lot of guns. I'm a gun control advocate, but I don't want to take people's guns. You know, I don't want to stop the legitimate use of firearms. And if you want to hunt in Montana or Wyoming or California or even you know, populated states like Maryland, Pennsylvania, where I used to hunt as a kid, you know, I'm not against that. And I think most people are not against that. But one thing is that we have to have sensible gun laws that fit each jurisdiction. And so the gun laws of Montana and the gun laws of Washington, D.C. got to be different.
Interesting. So what about Florida? Is that a beginning? Is that something that should resonate? Is that something that is a template for the rest of our country, our states?
You mean in terms of the changes that are happening now in Florida?
Right, that the governor signed on Friday.
Yeah. Well, there's a fascinating article in the New Yorker, a recent article, about a woman who is a lobbyist for the NRA in the state of Florida, that describes the type of power that she has in being a maker or breaker of political lives. So whatever Marianne Hammer says goes in the state of Florida. She was responsible for the Stand Your Ground law, which I think personally is an appalling law. So, it's a state-by-state change, and thank goodness Governor Scott made those changes. But let's see what happens legislatively down the road if things are reversed. I think this is a concerted effort. I commend the students from Parkland High School. I think they're sensational. I think they are calling us adults out and saying, do your job. This is your job is to protect American lives, American citizens. So let's hope they continue their efforts, and I'm really looking forward to this big march they're doing on the 24th of this month.
It's very exciting what's happening right now in Florida, because this is the state that gave us our first Stand Your Ground law, and it is the one that many other states have been modeled after. And for there to be any movement in the state of Florida is so encouraging, and it goes back to the power of the voice and the power of the participation in the legislative process. And that's what we are trying to bring awareness to, because I actually did not grow up in Montana. I actually grew up in this area, and I grew up going to the NRA rifle range, and I grew up shooting with my father from the ages of 12 to about 13 when I discovered boys. It was a common occurrence for us to go out to the range on Saturdays and to shoot. And in 1871, when the NRA was created, it was created because of the poor shots of the Union soldiers.
Yes.
And it
yes.
wanted to increase the marksmanship. And then,
it's
you know,
amazing.
And then as it grew, you know, it started being an advocacy organization for not just people who, you know, were trying to be better shots, but also for hunters and collectors and so forth. But somewhere
but most
along
importantly,
the line,
it wasn't political.
It was not political.
It got overtaken like in the 20s and the 30s. But they also were behind gun responsibility legislation
exactly.
initially.
Right.
And somehow they got co-opted.
Yeah. Well, my husband also grew up in a rural state, and he had a gun when he was 12, and he went out hunting with his dad. But the NRA was all about safety, about training, and their whole focus was the responsibility of the person using the gun. And they have gotten so far away from that mandate. And that's what they need to return to. They need to return to their roots.
They've been co-opted by the corporate industry, the gun manufacturers. I mean, several of their members on the board are gun manufacturers and ammunition manufacturers. They've got, you know, millions and millions of dollars being funneled into the organization to promote the sale of rifles.
And which is fine, but let's do it sensibly, responsibly, legally, morally. There's nothing wrong with having a gun. But
the fact that
politics are involved, I mean, I my dad was a sharpshooter, a marksman. He went to a gun academy as a high school in Chicago. He would travel every day on public transportation with his rifle in his lap. And I grew up with guns everywhere, and never have we had any problems. And by the way, I'm one of four. None of us own a gun, but my dad did. He was a collector and as I said, a sharpshooter and a marksman and a hunter. Where it got from that to where it is today is reprehensible.
Well, you can look at the failure of Congress to renew the assault weapons ban in 2004, because we have statistics that showed that the incidence of mass murder killings went down prior to the during the 10 years of the ban, and went up over 200% in the 10 years after the ban. But 12 of the 22 corporate sponsors, patrons of the NRA, make assault weapons. And
well, yeah, and that's absolutely right. And I just want to point out on the side of politicians, something you said earlier about the National Rifle Association and about people getting involved in the legislature. That's what we really need to do. We need to get involved in influencing legislators, because that's the only way to counteract the power of the NRA. I know plenty of good politicians that, in fact, the two past governors of Virginia and I worked together for many years. And I can tell you, it's hard for a politician to step up to the plate in a state where guns are important and make the right choices. And the only way to counter, because the NRA puts so much money into it, so much
exactly.
money against you if you stand up for it. In D.C., we were on the verge of passing a law that gave a vote for the first time in 217 years to our delegate, Eleanor Holmes Norton. And it failed in the Senate because a guy named John Ensign from Nevada put a gun rider on it. This does not only affect directly gun policy, it affects other policies as well, because the NRA doesn't like D.C. They see it because of our strong gun laws. So the only way to counteract their money is to get involved and say, they may stand against you, but we're not going to vote for you if you don't stand up on the right side of this issue. Mm-hmm. And I think all the morphing has been of the NRA and their original position has been just pouring tons and tons of money in it. And you need money to run for politics, you know, in office. And I train politicians. I train people that want to run for the public office. And the first thing we say to them is you have to get elected. You have to get elected. So it's very powerful force when you're sitting there and you're thinking, boy, I may not get elected if I take this position. So we've got to counteract that. Ladies, tell us what people are saying to you when you, what kind of reception are you get when you talk to people that are NRA members or people that are gun advocates when you're in front of the White House? What are the kind of things that you're hearing out there?
We really hear a variety of things. Sometimes when we have had conversations with NRA members, at the conclusion of a conversation, and as I said at the beginning, our whole focus is on civility. And frequently what people have said who are NRA members is, wow, thank you for not yelling at me. Mm. And so I think that it is that culture that doesn't come at a problem in a sort of a soft manner, a manner of listening to the other side. I think that may be the culture of the NRA, and it may be sensible for their members to understand that we're not against them, that we don't want to fight them, that we want to join to create a safer country. This is all our country, and we may come from it from different political points of view or whatever, but the bottom line is this is where we live, and we want to live safely, and we want to live together.
One of the things that I usually bring up when I first start to engage with somebody who is interested in this issue is, you know, if they are a gun owner, are they a responsible gun owner? Do they lock up their guns? Do they keep their ammunition separate from the guns? Once we start to dialogue and they say, yes, I do these things, then we can start to talk about, well, what are the responsibility of other gun owners that don't do those things, and how we who do not own guns can be impacted by their mishandling of guns. So that's often a way to begin a dialogue with it. But, you know, I really don't think that the political branch of the NRA represents the majority of their members, because the political branch is really representing better the industry interests. And what other industry has as big a hold on American politics as the gun manufacturers do because of this issue? I mean, when
Michael, can you speak to that?
That's a big statement there. In my world, nobody has a bigger hold. A single entity has a bigger hold on politics in America than the National Rifle Association.
So there not petroleum?
No.
Not climate change?
No.
Not gender issues?
No. You look at what just happened with the president and the tariffs. You know, president passed these tariffs laws, and the steel workers and people in Alabama and Pennsylvania that make steel stood up and applauded. But that's a handful of people compared to the people that the NRA controls and the money that the NRA controls. I'm not sure who puts, maybe the Koch brothers, I don't know, who puts more money into politics than the NRA, but where I come from, let me tell you. Yeah.
So
everybody always talks about them.
I want to hear more about this lobbyist from Florida. Why is she so powerful?
She controls the money that comes from the NRA that funds the political campaigns. And so we're talking millions and millions of dollars.
So not just Florida, then, the United States.
Yeah, that's true. But Florida has made these significant passages, significant laws, including the Stand Your Ground law, which now exists in 12 other states, and has been shown over and over and over again to protect white shooters from their African-American victims. So that it kind of creates this horrible imbalance in the law. And lawmakers, people who work for, the prosecutors who run departments of law, police, they don't like this Stand Your Ground law. It's a frightening thing when people take the law into their own hands. Mm-hmm. And that's not what America is based on. We're a nation of laws, and we need to figure out how to follow the laws respectfully.
When you asked about the influence of this one industry on American politics, and, I would point out that we are in an epidemic. When you have had more than 1.5 million people die from gun violence, when you have over 100,000 people being shot a year, when you have 38,000 people dying a year, when two-thirds of those are suicide victims that are getting access to guns, and we know that if you have a gun and you try to commit suicide, you're 90% more likely to be successful. We have all these issues as an epidemic, and then we have very simple, not very controversial issues that the majority, 95% of the population in the U.S. support background checks. When we have solutions that could address some of these things, just like we learn to license cars and require people to have driving, safety and pass tests, and we can't get anything because the industry sees that anything, if we give any movement, that could be reduced sales. Why have we not put a restriction on bump stocks? That's not a very controversial issue, I don't think. But, research. Why can't we do research? Why can't we do background checks? Why can't we require responsible gun ownership? Why can't we limit firearms from individuals that are experiencing a mental health crisis? Why don't we recognize the effect of guns and domestic violence and shut down the boyfriend loophole that allows a domestic partner who has if a person has a restraining order on their domestic partner but they're not married, they can still get a gun. There are so many things that we could do. That why can't we look at smart gun technology? Or there are so many things that aren't controversial, and yet we do nothing and have done nothing for a decade, for more. And that goes back to the influence of money in politics on this issue.
Well, I can tell you that if you wanted to reform politics in America, the best thing you could do is try to get the private money out. The best thing you could do is limit the amount of money that goes into it, because it really does corrupt the system dramatically. And the, mm-hmm. and the thing that bothers me most about the NRA approach is it's based on fear. When you talk about the Stand Your Ground law, for example, it's based on fear, and it plays on people's prejudices.
Mm-hmm. Speaking to this issue, I have had women say to me, "Oh, well, yeah, I bought a gun because I'm afraid of my boyfriend." And mm-hmm. I have said, there is interesting information that shows that a gun in your home makes you less safe. Because it's likely that maybe your boyfriend will find it and he'll use it on you. It may not keep you safe in the way that you think it will. And it's this whole notion that we don't talk to each other. We pick up a gun to make our point. So I find that very chilling. I think it's an important thing that you know, maybe this goes back to our educational system, having kids learn in school how important it is to communicate with each other, and not to seek a final solution, so to speak, through the barrel of a gun when you've got a problem.
And it also goes to what you were saying, Michael, in the sense of the NRA selling fear, because it really comes down to whether you think a gun makes you safer or makes you less safe. And without the research and the statistics and being able to really educate people, then what you make your decision on is often what you're told. And when you have the NRA saying you are more safe with a gun and that sells more guns, then, you know, that is overriding. But what we do know from what little research we have is that, first of all, self-defense with a gun occurs in fewer than 1% of all contact crimes. The risk of death during a home invasion is 0.000002%, less than 1%, essentially zero. But we have now this climate of fear in our society. And, you know, we haven't talked about the mass shootings, which is the elephant in the room in a way. I mean, that's, you know, that's the thing that's really spurring this discussion, which is really only 1% of deaths occur from mass shootings. But the impact to society is so much more, because now everybody has fear. It is, you know, I don't see how anybody in our society can escape the fear that if they send their child to school, they might not come home. If they go to a concert, they could be attacked. Even though this is a small percentage of our deaths, it's a big impact to our society. But we can't even have a conversation about it.
Well, I think you're right, and I think it does involve changing the way people think. Because, look, I'm the father of two daughters. If one of my daughters came home and said, I'm buying a gun to protect me from my boyfriend, I think the first thing I'd say is, you're dating
the
wrong guy.
From the boyfriend.
Yeah. If you need a gun to protect yourself. But
what I think is that we need to know where to begin. Because what you women have done beautifully is let us know how egregious the situation is. But where does one start? You want to talk about a dialogue, but that's not going to do things. Michael, you talk about policy. That's where we make changes. You talk about money. That's where we can get priorities. But where does the average USA citizen begin?
Well, I think part of what has happened is that we're average. We are very average US citizens. And so we just got fed up. And we're moving slowly, but when we started out, there were three of us. And now there are typically 10 to 15 of us. And we pass out cards and we tell people, please, if this is an important issue to you, contact your congressman, contact the president. The power of your voice counts, and you have
but
to make it heard.
But say what? I'm concerned, or I need this to happen, or we need to change this. Like, walk us through that.
That it, first of all, that there is a problem that needs to be addressed legislatively. And the kids in Florida have it completely correct. We need to use our vote. I mean, these kids are saying, they're standing up, they're saying, first of all, they grew up going to school after Sandy Hook, where 20 young children were killed. Now, these kids have had active shooter drills in their schools as long as they can remember. Like, we grew up with the fear of nuclear war. They're growing up with the fear of someone coming into their school and killing them. So they're saying now that enough is enough, never again. That when they can start to vote, they're going to vote out legislators that make decisions solely based on the money received from the NRA or not received, the campaigning against you if you don't. So we need to be active with our voices politically and say, this is not a Democratic or Republican issue unless you are receiving sufficient amount of money that you won't even look at doing anything. And if that's the case, then we want somebody who will address the issue, that it's time that the issue be addressed, that we have a dialogue. You know, I worked in the Alaska legislature for 30 years, and I was nonpartisan. And my experience showed me that the best solution to any problem is when you have opposing opinions on both sides that are forced to talk to each other, that are forced to look for common grounds and to come up with the best product. But we have a political climate right now where there is no dialogue, because if you are in a state, a red state, and you support even, you know, closing background check loopholes, you'll get primaried out. So that's what we have to change.
Yeah, and it's very important. The only way to counteract, again, the impact of money is with votes.
Exactly.
Because in the bottom line, that's what money buys you in politics. So
we cannot outspend $11 billion industry.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's, I think that's the power of these Parkland students.
Right.
And I think that's what they're standing up and saying is, you know, talk to us. We'll vote you out.
Well, you know, and you said it earlier, ladies, about being children of the 60s. I'm a child of the 60s, and I went out and protested the Vietnam War, and a lot of people got together, young people, and did it. And, you know, the thing that finally ended it was I think that the impact that voters had when mothers got tired of seeing their kids come home and body bags, and it was on TV, and people embraced it and said, no, this is enough. We have to end this. And containment policy or not, we have to end this. And that's when it ended. And I think we have to do the
same. Well, we have to call out anybody who in the media says that these kids are crisis actors. So anytime that anybody tries to debunk the bravery of these kids and to turn that stuff all around, that just has to be called out and shown for what it is, because that's not progressing anything except more divisiveness.
And nothing will happen until more people speak up and make this an important issue. I mean, that's the bottom line. No matter where you are on the spectrum, you know, I've had, you know, we still own a gun. I've shot with the NRA. I've lived in states where hunting is very prominent. But if we don't, all of us, bring our voices forward and say, this is an issue that we need to look at and we need to solve, nothing will happen. And that's what's, you know, every major social change, whether it was civil rights, women getting the vote, you know, moms with drunk driving, you know, having stronger regulation, you know, it comes from the grassroots movement, or it comes from big money. And you can look at the history of the change in our country in lessening any kind of regulation against the use of guns, being caused by the influx of big money into the political system by the gun manufacturers.
So, Michael, do you think that what Florida adopted on Friday is a movement, or the beginning of momentum? Isolated? What is your perspective in terms of policy and politics?
Well, I think it is, and I think it's a step in the right direction. It's a small step, in my opinion, but it's a step in the right direction. And I think that that things are changing in terms of public opinion. You know, when you have this thing at Parkland, when you have the, you know, it happens all over the country now. Where are you safe? You're not safe in rural Colorado. You're not safe in Florida. You're not safe in Connecticut.
You're not safe in a veterans home in Northern California.
Right. Right. Or Virginia Tech, or, you know, look at all these places. I think it's starting to register with people that something really, really needs to be done. So I think it's a first step, and it's a small step. But
why do you say small? Don't you think it's big? There was three big things, and a Republican governor, no less.
Well, big in maybe in that sense, but it's, you know,
18 to 21, no bump stocks.
18 to 21, you know.
And a background check in 3 days.
Yeah,
small,
no,
in the sense it's one state.
Right, and
yeah,
we
but
also
it's the
have
first.
Eight,
it's the
we
beginning.
Also have eight million of these assault rifles in our in our country. 8 million assault rifles.
So now we need to do amnesty, turn in.
Maybe, or you know, at least the assault weapons ban again, reimpose that, because that's what's happening. Look, the NRA position that the only way to stop a bad man with a gun is a good man with a gun is ridiculous. The way to stop a bad man with a gun is to take his gun away. Take the guns away from the bad men, not the good people, not people that are out hunting, not responsible gun owners, but get the guns out of the hands of the bad people. And I think that's what we have to do. And bump stock, you know, a bump stock may allow you to kill 100 people in a shopping mall. But you know what? A semi-automatic handgun or an AR-17, look at how many people you can kill with that. Those are the things that we need to, I think, focus on. And that's why I say it's a small step in solving the problem. But I agree with you, Maria. For a Republican governor to do that in Florida, that's a big deal for him.
And it shows that, you know, the bottom line is that politicians want to get reelected. When the kids first went to Florida to try to talk to their representatives, they weren't even able to get meetings with any from one side from the Republicans except for one. But after the movement started growing and they realized that this was something that they had more and more constituents being concerned with, then they reversed themselves and they took action. So no matter how much money is going into politics, they still have to get elected. The money helps them get elected. But if the voices are stronger, then that will, you know, make movement. And I agree. I'm very encouraged with the change in Florida.
I'm glad to hear that. Thank you.
You know, and, you know, our Second Amendment rights are not all or nothing. Every constitutionally guaranteed right comes with responsibilities and limitations. We can uphold the Second Amendment and still pass reasonable regulations that further the public's interest in safety. Mm.
And we have Taboo on line two. Welcome, Taboo, to the program. Thank you for joining us.
I thank all of you. And you all don't need to say you need to start the conversation, because you all have done it, and I thank you all for having it. And thank you particularly for Senator Brown and Maria for having the show. But you all are focusing on the key, and I'd like for you to answer the question. You're saying the bad people, yes. Let's identify the bad people. And my question is, who in our communities has, and I say communities, plural, because it's all over, it's global, who has the power to create such travesty on our people? What single, and NRA is not a gun manufacturer, I don't think.
No, they're the lobbying arm of the gun manufacturer.
Right, but I thought I heard someone say earlier the NRA. So they're not the problem, but who has the power? Even a gun manufacturer. Somebody in our community, let's look at our school shooting. And I think if we're going to be honest about this, and which we really should, and that's the only reason I'm calling, is because I feel we can have an honest discussion, I'll ask the question, is there a certain part or parts of our government that has an integral part in what is going on? Now, let's be honest. If we can't be honest, let's don't even talk about it.
Well, they're certainly complicit. I think everybody here would agree that they go along with the NRA in many cases. So in that sense, the government is complicit in what's going on, because they're not taking steps to prevent it. And I think that the statistics that these women have mentioned tonight on the show shows that there's a clear indication, and we know for a fact, that less guns, less murders. So the facts are out there, but the government is very often through the political process is afraid to intervene. So in that sense, the government, yeah, is a problem. They're complicit in the problem. Don't you agree, okay, ladies?
Yes, I do.
Well, and it's both sides too, because you know, whereas more commonly Republican legislators are lockstep with the lobbying group and the money interested from the NRA, but the Democrats have also been afraid to take up the issue. So it goes on both sides.
Yep, absolutely. And we
Kevin,
see that.
Did that answer your question?
Please.
Did that
answer?
Yeah.
Well, I think I'm looking. Well, I'd like to ask another question, if I may, because I respect everybody's opinion and answers. Is there an arm of government that actually puts guns in our communities and does a lot of bad stuff?
Well, I don't know about that.
Well,
yeah,
we really need to have a real look. Rather than talk, let us do some investigation, because I think. Some of us aren't, well, maybe we just, so many of us are ill-informed. Maybe I'm ill-informed.
Well, one of the things we could do is allow the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Bureau to provide the public with information about the use of guns and who has the guns. And unfortunately, Congress passed an amendment that prohibit them to share that information with the public or even with Congress. So unless we can reverse that, we don't know
that
information of who has the guns and how they're being used.
Hey, Tabu, it sounds to me, though, like you have some solutions.
I'm sorry, say again?
It sounds to me like you might have some solutions.
Well, I think we all do, but I think for some reason we are afraid to talk, and that is the problem.
Exactly.
There is fear. We all live in fear, and we're afraid of our government, and I think that's a part of the problem. We have false securities, people go and pray. I mean, prayer's fine, but I don't think prayer is a realistic security. I think it was you, Helen, who mentioned the media. Why isn't the media talking more about this, our solutions, instead of just everybody talking about NRA. NRA is not the problem.
That's a good question. That's an excellent question.
Well, I think my answer to that question, Tabu, is because sensationalism sells, you know, and I mean, you know, I just went to the movies last night with my wife and saw Black Panther. There's a lot of explosions, a lot of, but you know, those things sell. And I think the news media glams onto that. 17 dead in a high school, unfortunately, grabs everybody's attention for the news cycle. So I don't know how much we can rely on them to resolve the problem, but
I don't think they can resolve it, but I think they have to report it honestly.
Yeah, so,
that would help us. That would help us. Now let's go look. Let's look at Parkland. Is it true that one of the teachers, and like we say, I don't know, because all I know is what I hear, just like anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
Is it true that one of the teachers said that the shooter that she saw had a gas mask on and some of the armor or something? Is that real?
I have not heard that.
Neither have I.
I hear you. When you, I try to get, you know, listen to whatever I can from various places, and it sounds like what I'm hearing from one media, as they call MS mainstream media, is somewhat different from what you're hearing somewhere else. So, is the media part of the problem by not properly educating the people, reporting proper news or real news?
Well, that would assume that what you heard, was truth. I mean, that would assume that happened. That the child or the student did have a gas mask, and it wasn't reported on by the mainstream media. But we don't have any indication that that is factual at this point.
But it boils down to the human condition. And having hosted a morning drive radio program, which means you get the news while everyone's been asleep, and as my sources were AP, and then the UK, and then the Washington Post, and the New York Times, the same story had four different sets of details. Because at the end of the day, it's a human being that gets and deciphers and has a byline. And I'm like, wait a second, there was one incident. How can there be four different perspectives? Well, it's because it's humans.
Right.
Somebody's deliberately misinterpreting things, but because a car accident happens and you have four different vantage points, you see different things.
Well, ladies, this is a discussion. Taboo, thanks for calling in.
Taboo, this is a discussion
that we're going to have to continue. And just the media aspect, we should do a whole show on that. But unfortunately, we've run out of time here.
I agree. Thanks. Bye-bye, everybody.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
And I want to meet you when I'm in D.C.
Come to the north side of the White House any Monday from 11 to 1. We're there. And we love anybody to come join us. We have extra signs. If you want to hold a sign for a while, you don't have to stay the whole time. You can come. It's a very open group. Everybody is welcome.
Say that one more time so our listeners know. What time?
11 to 1.
11
Eastern
to 1.
Daylight time.
Every Monday. And now it's getting warmer, so it'll be lovely to be out there. And we'll have cherry blossoms.
All right. Well, Helen and Luann, thank you so much for being on the show.
You.
We're going to play you out tonight with a song that I dedicate to these two brave women that go out to the White House every day. When in doubt, rely on the Beatles. We can work it out.
Perfect. Thanks.
And to thank you for our listeners
who helped make us
a part of your daily experience.
Sure. Thank you.
Thanks.
Try to see it my way. Do I have to keep on talking till I can go on? While you see it your way, run the risk of knowing that our love may soon be gone. We can work it out. We can work it out. Think of what you're saying. You can get it wrong and still you think that it's all right. Think of what I'm saying. We can work it out and get it straight. I'll see you.
Representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.